Good morning.
Good morning.
What's going on?
No video.
No video.
What's going on?
I decided to turn that off.
You fixed that glitch, huh?
Yeah. If I'm going all nude, I turned it off.
Well, okay. I guess I should be grateful.
Yeah. So, how you doing?
Pretty good. I had a long week of cold and snow.
Yeah, I have to go back to work.
Yeah, you've been off since the last time we talked, haven't you?
Yeah, it's been quite some time. I don't remember what it's like to work.
Yeah, that's a long break. Usually if I'm off work for that long, it's a rude awakening when I go back. It's like a shock to the system.
Yeah. It probably will be.
Yeah. Now, we had, most of the Northeast towards the end of last week was covered in a storm, and we didn't have it as bad here as some places, but it was bad enough that Thursday and Friday my trips back and forth to work were pretty tedious and had a lot of snow coming in and a lot of cold.
Do you have four-wheel drive or no?
No.
Oh.
No, I mean, I'm pretty good at driving in snow.
I'm not.
I mean, I guess just from practice, but...
I'm sliding all over yesterday.
Yeah. Kara has snow tires that she has put on her car every winter, but all I have is my tires are a little bit better than normal tires. They're all-weather tires, so they have a little bit better of a tread on them for dealing with snow, but they're definitely not, you know, snow tires. But yeah, I mean, mostly I didn't have a lot of sliding around or anything like that. Mostly it was just slow.
Yeah.
You know, it took me...
How much snow did you get?
I don't know altogether. You know, probably 6 or 7 inches. Not all at once, but I did have to run the snowblower a few times to clear the driveway, and some of it was just all the schools in the area were closed on Friday, but that was not due to snow; it was due to the wind chill.
Mm-hmm.
Kids waiting for the buses and stuff. It was that morning, Friday morning. It was like 13 below zero, like wind chill.
Yeah. So. Wow. Well, right now it's one over here, but. We got about 5 inches yesterday, so we're still debating if we're going to drive to my brother's today or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually been, yesterday and today it was actually 33 degrees right now, according to my thing on my computer, so it's funny how that feels warm relatively after being negative 13, because it's like negative 13, you can start to feel your nose hairs freezing up.
Yeah.
When you're out there.
Yeah, I know what that's like.
Yeah.
Poor Harley, she hasn't been out since like midnight last night. Mm. She doesn't want to go out. She's like, screw that, I'll just sleep all day. I'll hold it.
See, Luna, she loves this. She's in her prime. I put her last night, we were both exhausted and, you know, it was real cold out. We put her on the line out back, and I was just standing there watching her. And she's just taking her time, walking around, exploring the backyard. And you'd never know that she's going to be 15 in a month, because she's hopping around and running back and forth across the backyard and sniffing the snow and digging her head in it, just having a good time back there.
Harley doesn't like it. She's doesn't like cold weather. She's so much likes heat.
Yeah, that's probably common for her breeds, right?
Yeah, well, she's short-haired.
Yeah.
So. Very short hair.
Yeah. Yeah, Luna, I mean, she's a mix of a bunch of different breeds, but most of her breeds are cold weather breeds. Mm. So that's her element. She hates the summertime.
You think, though, that she wouldn't like it because of she's getting old and arthritis and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. We've actually been taking her. She especially has arthritis in her back legs, and we've been but like the main arthritis medicine she can't take because of her breed. It'll bother her liver.
Yeah.
So, but we've been taking her for this laser therapy treatment, and it actually seems like it's helping because she's gone through most of it now. She's got, I think, one more appointment. But her back leg, because her back legs were, she'd just be standing there. It didn't seem to bother her, but she'd just be standing there and her back legs would be shaking.
Yeah.
And they haven't been doing that lately.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, so, but she's, you know, she's definitely, she shows signs of age, but for the fact she's going to be 15, she's looking pretty good.
Yeah, especially if she's going out there in bad conditions and enjoying it.
Yeah, you wouldn't know. She's acting like a puppy out there.
Yeah. So, you didn't get to do your homework.
No.
The dog ate your homework.
Damn it. The inept packager or whoever screwed things up.
It sucks because, man, I loved it. I could hardly wait to talk about it.
Yeah, are we gonna still keep it a secret?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we should.
Yeah. But next time, I'll be ready next time. I dropped I had to return my item.
Mm-hmm.
I dropped that in yesterday, and I think I'm just gonna get a refund on that. So I'll reorder. And I think I'm just going to reorder a newer version.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll be ready next time.
Cool deal.
Yeah. So, we're just going to talk about random comics this time, I guess. I got two Marvels and three DCs.
Nice. And I got all indies.
Account. Oh, okay. So, I'll be the corporate. I'll be corporate.
Well, I have one Marvel I want to briefly mention, but just because it's a little bit different than something I normally get.
That's fine. I'll allow it.
Well, I want to cheat, too. I want to break our rule. I have something that's 8 years old.
Well, at least it's close. It's pretty damn close, man. I was looking at my shelf, and there was a couple things I pulled off my trade shelf and flipped open and looked at the originally published date.
Yeah,
it was only like 4 years old, so I'm like, that's too close. But yeah, I'll be corporate America this time, and you can be the Occupy Comics movement.
That's right, Occupy Comics. It's interesting how I did a lot of back issue purchasing over the holidays.
Yeah, you've been sharing some photos of stuff that you've
been. Got a lot of stuff. I completed some runs. I completed Fate, which is a Dr. Fate series. I almost completed my Deathstroke, the Terminator. I got about 10 issues left. And then the Demon, I have like 4 issues left of that. So I'm getting close on some of the runs. But then I got like attention deficit disorder again, and got some things that, like Doc Savage, I bought a lot of. Now I have pretty much a full run of all the Marvel and DC Doc Savage, plus almost the full run of the magazine, which I'm getting really into the magazines. They're fucking cool, like the Marvel magazines. It's like they're pulling me in, even though they're black and white and stuff. They're really awesome. Which is bad, but
yeah.
It's one more thing to get into and more boxes that are bigger to store magazines in.
Yeah, Barb told me she was excited to see a lot of new comics showing up.
I'm sure she did.
She's going to be standing in front of the mailbox and just going to push the mailman away.
Send her.
Yeah.
I didn't order any of this shit.
She's just gonna. She watches a lot of football, so she's just gonna run and tackle the mailman when he tries to deliver.
Yeah,
stuff.
I got a lot of Red Wolf.
What's that?
That's a Native American Western hero that later came up in the Avengers and other books as part of the Texas Rangers. You know, that Midwest superhero team.
Oh, okay.
Like the Texas Twister and Firebrand and a couple, I can't remember, Firebird. And he was one of them. But I guess he started off originally as a Western, and I started reading a lot of that stuff. And I got all of his, I'm working on getting all his appearances now that I finished the Man Wolf. I've moved on to the Red Wolf. So
working on completing your wolf collection.
Yeah, it's really cool stuff. I like it. Some more Bronze Age Marvel stuff. And there's other stuff that I purchased too, but I can't remember all of it. I finished Amethyst.
Oh yeah, that's right. You
posted every incarnation of it. Yeah. So now I have all of her appearances, and I didn't really have any Amethyst until I read the New 52, you know, Sword of Sorcery.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it so much. I was like, I gotta check this out. I blew it off as like a, when I was younger, as a My Little Pony kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't want to get into it, but it really is awesome.
Yeah, I read there was a preview that was around the time when DC was doing those preview inserts, and there was one for Amethyst.
Yeah.
I forget what the comic it was that it appeared in, but that was pretty good, and I read a couple issues of the New 52 Amethyst. It definitely is a franchise that has crossover appeal.
Yeah, it's good fantasy and sword and sorcery type stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's just
definitely
a damn shame the market can't support anything that's different.
Yeah, I think that property has some value, but I think it would have had to been a little bit more aggressive in marketing it and getting the word out there, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not placing all the blame on DC, but you know, I don't know if they had the resources to focus on that aggressively as it would need, you know, and still have time to market everything else. But
yeah, they go into these things and they probably already know they're not gonna have a good ongoing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a shame that the superhero genre is so dominant in sales numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice to get some other kind of genres in there, especially in the big two. Like, yeah, we can get other genres from independent stuff, but the big two is almost all dominated by superhero stuff.
Yeah, I think it comes down to their expectations, because it seems like stuff outside of superhero genre it'll sell enough copies for the expectations of any publisher but Marvel and DC, you know. But something that's a good seller for Boom, you know, isn't gonna cut the mustard for what, you know, Marvel is looking for a title to do.
Yeah.
You know, they'll cut that and publish, you know, something else.
Let them get the scraps. Let them fight over it.
Yeah.
So what did you read?
All right, well, I was going to mention that I read a couple things that did, you know, talking about that attention deficit order. I tend to read stuff that, you know, if I pick up back issues from a 50 Cent bin or something like that, I'll usually, if I don't get them right then, I'll usually wait till I have, you know, not a whole run of the title at least, but at least a few issues in a row. But then every once in a while, I'm trying to decide what I want to read to talk about on the show, and I'll look at one of my boxes and see something, just a single issue, and I'll just try it out and you know, see what my reaction is. And then if I do like it, that's when I end up starting to think about, oh, maybe I, you know, looking on the back issue market and stuff to see what the other issues around that issue are. You know, what their availability and their cost is and stuff. And two of those are two of the DCs that I read today, because these are ones I just grabbed because they have the special Crisis crossover heading. And, you know, those, the Crisis on Infinite Earth tie-ins, I always grab those if it's one that I don't have. And
so you could see the red sky.
Yeah. And, you know, because I haven't read a lot of the crossovers. I've read, I read Crisis on Infinite Earths two or three times now. You know, I read it originally. I bought an auction of all the issues on eBay back when I first started getting interested in DC. And I think a lot of people end up doing this. You know, you hear about it when you start learning about DC Comics, and then you read it and you don't really understand a lot of what's going on because you don't know DC that well. But, I mean, you can still enjoy the overall storyline, I've found. But then you go back to it and read it again after you've read more DC, and you get something else out of it. And, you know, like, you, the more you know about DC and the more that you've read surrounding issues and stuff that were going on at the time, the more you can get out of it. You get different things out of it each time you read it. And so reading these, I read one of them that I read was, the first one I read was Fury of Firestorm, number 41.
And it's one of my all-time favorites.
Is it? Yeah. This. So, I mean, I know I've heard the reputation that some tie-ins don't, you know, the amount that they have to do with the Crisis event varies. But I figured that this one would be fairly, you know, fairly strong tie-in because of the cover is actually has Harbinger in the foreground and Psycho Pirate in the background. So, this seems to be a fairly early tie-in to the, because most of the references are to the first issue of Crisis, and it actually opens with a page and a half of Lila separating into the various Harbingers. So that was kind of a neat sequence, and it also turns out that this story, it's called Storm Warning, and it was when Jerry Conway was still writing it, and the artist is Raphael Kayanin, who I've heard of especially in reference to Firestorm, but I haven't necessarily seen a lot of his work. But it turned out that this also was kind of a good issue to pick up and read, because as I found out later, like, the previous issue is where Firestorm graduated, well, specifically Ronnie graduated from high school, and this is the first issue where he's moved to Pittsburgh and to go to college, and that was kind of neat because I actually lived in college, lived in college.
you lived in college?
I really lived in I lived it up in college, let me tell you.
I lived with Ronnie in college, so
yeah,
we were roommates.
And I was trying to take Professor Stein's place, but he wouldn't let me be a part of Firestorm, so I just made out with Killer Frost. But
and you made it.
Yeah.
She didn't suck all your energy out.
Nope. I was just an ice slave for a while. I lived in Pittsburgh later. This took place in a... this came out in 85, so it was much later. I live in Pittsburgh, but it was kind of neat because you can see some of the, you know, the Pittsburgh landmark bridges and stuff in the background, some of these scenes. But, so they're just, Firestorm is just getting to Pittsburgh, and, you know, it's interesting because he kind of worries because he runs into Doreen, who is Ronnie's girlfriend at the moment. And he's worried that she's going to figure out that he's Firestorm because she'd seen him a lot back when they lived in New York. And then all of a sudden she moves to Pittsburgh and sure enough, Firestorm shows up. So, you know, either that or she's going to start worrying that she's being stalked by a superhero.
Who's this guy who's following me?
Yeah, she's like, what the hell is she, you know, she even thinks, everywhere I go, first at Bradley High in New York, now at Vandermeer University in Pittsburgh, there he is. Is he following me or what? So, but yeah, sure enough, we get some red skies and Harbinger and Psycho Pirate teleport in above one of the university's buildings. And Harbinger leaves Psycho Pirate alone, tells him just to wait there. But of course, you know, Psycho Pirate, he doesn't really want to be a part of any of this in the first place. So he starts to take off and doesn't listen to her as soon as she leaves. And, you know, as we see Ronnie getting acclimated to his new place and everything like that, and also Professor Stein has taken a appointment in the physics department there as a new teacher, so that, you know, he'll be around Ronnie as well, and they can continue to adventure as Firestorm. Psycho Pirate's kind of creeping around the university, and he's peeking in through a window and happens to make contact with Professor Stein, and Professor Stein sees Psycho Pirate without his without the Medusa mask on, and so Stein starts freaking out because he, you know, Psycho Pirate transfers his emotions to whoever sees him without the mask. So he's afraid at the moment. So that's what takes over Professor Stein, is the like sensation of terror. So, you know, while that's going on, Harbinger appears to Ronnie, because the whole reason that they're there is that they need Firestorm. So this is kind of, I believe, if I remember correctly, when you're reading Crisis, you know, Firestorm kind of just shows up with Killer Frost and a few other people. So this kind of gives us a backstory of how he was recruited, I guess. It's been a little while since I read Crisis, but I think that's how this would fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while Ronnie's freaking out, or excuse me, while Professor Stein's freaking out, they form Firestorm. So Firestorm, you know, within Ronnie is telling Professor Stein to calm down because he's being affected by him now and his heartbeat going super fast and everything like that. Firestorm comes in contact with Psycho Pirate as well, but this time Psycho Pirate is pissed off at his whole circumstance, and so Firestorm gets taken over by rage, and there's a bit of a battle between him and Harbinger. Eventually Psycho Pirate and Harbinger come back together, and Harbinger is able to point out the Psycho Pirate, because he's a little bit unstable, you know, that it's his fault that Firestorm is freaking out. So Psycho Pirate is able to, you know, look at him again with a calmer demeanor, and Firestorm calms down. And this is where, you know, Harbinger tells him that he's needed to help out with this storm that's brewing on the horizon and the red skies and everything. And he's a little bit upset when Harbinger tells him that they're going to go actually recruit Killer Frost, but he doesn't really have much of a time to protest because Harbinger teleports the three of them to back into the Crisis miniseries, basically. So that kind of ties things in there, but yeah, it was a cool issue. I'm not real well versed on Firestorm. You know, I have a few issues, and I have a few insights into, you know, his introduction as a character and his joining the Justice League, and so I kind of know the basics of his history and the incarnations. But
Jerry Conway created him to have somebody like a Peter Parker in the DCU.
Yeah.
I mean,
I've heard that, yeah.
Somebody that was younger and people could relate to, where at mm-hmm. that time, I think nobody could relate to their iconic figures.
Yeah.
They wanted to make a guy who has everyday problems, and he's a jock who's a football player that gets transformed with this professor. And he's not always the brightest guy.
Yeah, and I thought that this was interesting because this is, I've read some of the earlier stuff, but it was interesting to see how, even though a lot of this is concerning a crossover with Crisis, I was intrigued by the life continuity moments of, Ronnie's actually going to be going to college, not for sports necessarily, but, it's weighted towards the physical sciences. So it seems like, I get the impression that without reading, the intervening issues in the early 80s, that Ronnie's been affected intellectually by his association with Professor Stein.
Yeah, yeah.
So
he definitely evolves. But he's got an interesting rogues gallery, too. Killer Frost is one of the main ones, and he actually developed a pretty good depth of rogues gallery where some of these newer heroes, I think, struggle to find identity and then end up fighting villains that have already been established.
Right. Yeah, so this was a good issue. I was able to read it and understand what's going on without the background, but it also made me want to check out some more. I noticed that, Jerry Conway's on the title for a little bit longer, but the following year is when he abruptly left, and I think it's John Ostrander that takes over.
Yeah.
And then eventually we get into that elemental firestorm and stuff.
Yeah. But the writing quality still stays pretty top-notch.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I've heard a lot when it relates to Firestorm, so I should say that it's actually the Fire and Water podcast and the Firestorm fan blog that a guy named Shag does. He's a huge Firestorm fan, and a lot of what I've learned about Firestorm comes through him. He's such a big fan, but this was a good issue, and makes me want to check out some more Firestorm. I have just random issues of this run, not that many, but I might pick up some more because of this.
Yeah, that's one of the back issues that I went to fill in, and I read every issue because I got sucked into it.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of getting my ADD where I go off and start something else, I actually finished it. So.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I question. I right now, I wanted to be able to just pick up 42 and read it, but I couldn't. So I'm thinking, well, I'll order it, but then I'm wondering, by the time these come, am I gonna read them, or am I gonna set them aside because I'm already interested in something else? So
right.
That's the call I gotta make. But and as long as I know it's something that, even if I don't read it when it comes in, I have stuff like that I've done that with, but I know I will end up reading when the mood strikes me again,
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Well, I had the same sort of experience with my pick. I picked when I went to CampbellCon, which is a con that Chris Campbell hosts right before Baltimore Comic Con, which is my favorite con because it's just a bunch of us, people that love comics that we know each other fairly well on the forums and stuff, physically get to meet and talk comics and trade comics and bring comics. And John Thurman brought me a bunch of he always sees stuff on my Facebook wall and stuff where I go on these tangents where I'm like, oh, I'm loving the Green Hornet or the pulp characters, or he knows I love Jack Kirby, so he'll save me some Jack Kirby. Or if I go on my Doc Savage kick, he got me some old Doc Savage Millennium comics.
Nice.
But he did this last time. He gave me some Green Hornet comics from the Now publication, which was in the 90s. Now was publishing Green Hornet. And it was a fairly popular comic at the time. I mean, for an independent comic, they revised the Green Hornet franchise, and they kind of did what Dynamite did, where they just published a bunch of different titles at one time. And I just want to talk about too briefly. Both of them came with like special items. This one was an anniversary special, which is an interesting packaging of the product because it says Green Hornet number 1, but you open the cover and you see it's Green Hornet number 12 with a number 1 rebranding. So it's really number 12, but I guess he was celebrating an anniversary, so they just restarted it at 1, and then the numbering continued after this miniseries ended, so I don't understand it. So it's a very weird thing, but it came with like a little pin, like a metallic metal pin that you can put on your garment, and which was really cool. So this was called the Odyssey of the Crimson Wasp, and it suckered me in because it wasn't even about the Green Hornet, but it was about Kato's sister. So it got into Kato's family and Kato's sister, and she was a smart... She's not only badass at fighting like Kato, because they both learned from their father, but she's also very, very intelligent. And turns out Kato's father is very rich, and he owns like a pharmaceutical company. And he wanted her to go out there to fix some problems. It's not just pharmaceuticals. He owns a lot of like plants around the world, and she's going over there to help with a particular technical problem that they're having. And she meets this mysterious dude who picks her up at the airport, and he kind of drops out of the picture for a while, but he's just there to, you know, because the father wants her picked up, so he's like the ass kicker dude. Like, I'm not ass kicker, ass kisser. You know, like, I work for your dad, and I'm going to pick you up and treat you good and that kind of stuff. And he picks her up and treats her good, takes her there, and then he never sees her again. And she then uncovers, like, a money laundering thing that's going on within the company while she's working there. And she goes and reports it to that guy that picked her up at the airport. And he says, oh, I'm glad you reported this. I'll take care of it, which is kind of mysterious. Mm-hmm. She never tells her father. She's, you know, I'll take care of why you're losing, you know, $100 million or whatever. And he's an asshole. The guy ends up framing somebody else for his crime. And that guy... he hangs him and kills him, and so everybody thinks that this guy laundered all the money, but he didn't. It was really this guy that's working for her father. And during this time, she falls in love with a police cop, and he's got an older daughter. I would say she's like 18, maybe. She's probably about 7. She's in high school years sometimes, and she becomes a good friend with his daughter, and they even get proposed to get married. And this guy breaks in the house, or has a bunch of goons break into the house, the guy who's laundering the money, and they end up shooting the cop, and I think they shot the daughter as well. So she's the only one that's left. And that's how the series ends, and you're like, what? And she's in the hospital, and she just came out of a coma. So you're like, wow, I want to know what happens. And it kind of leaves you hanging. But I really enjoy this story. The writer was Ron Fortier. I've never, ever heard of him. And the penciler, I'm not sure I've heard of either, who's Todd Smith. But I really enjoyed it. And it's a flashback issue because it really starts off with the Green Hornet and Kato talking to the Crimson Wasp, who's Kato's sister. And she's got like a superhero outfit. And she's just flashing back on when this other stuff happened.
Mm-hmm.
But now comics, you know, did revamp the Green Hornet and Speed Racer and Married with Children. I don't know if you ever heard of that comic, but they had a Married with Children comic.
And was it related to the TV show?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They did a couple other stuff like Fright Night and other items. Twilight Zone. They did a Twilight Zone comic. But I just want to mention the other one real briefly. It came with a hologram cover, which is, not a cover, but a card. Mm-hmm. It's Tales of the Green Hornet, number 1. And the thing that was nice about this is it was a done-in-one story. That was pretty cool. It was also a flashback scene where he went to this house where they were invited. It reminded me of like a Scooby-Doo mystery or something, but they were invited to this house where a bunch of rich people were invited, and this house was just remodeled, and Green Hornet thought, you know, there's something weird why he would have remodeled this and invited us here. Yeah. But there's a bunch of goons there that, like, lock him in this mansion and are there to kill all the rich people. So there's, like, 140 rich people in this place. And Britt Reed, who's the owner of the newspaper, is one of them. And they kill his girlfriend, the girl that he goes with. They kill a bunch of other people, you know, these gangsters. And they booby-trap the house. So it says, like, there was 120 people that went to this celebration, and only 74 of them survived after the Green Hornet took them out. So Britt Reed got into his outfit. But they had, like, traps in the mansion and people just being gunned down. It was kind of like a weird thing where the criminal element just said, we're going to get rid of all the rich people or the people that control all the money and wealth. That's an interesting story. It's all a done one.
Did those issues originally come polybagged so that?
Yeah, I opened up the polybag.
Man, John probably met those for your retirement.
Yeah. Unfortunately, these never took off. They're like probably a dollar bin items, you know, things you can find in the dollar bin.
Yeah.
But they were really good, really good stories. And that's the bad thing about getting these damn issues is I put in my mycomicshop.com want list, you know. So now I want to fill the Green Hornet Now Comics.
I don't know if I've ever heard of Now Comics. Were they around for a while or not really?
Yeah, they had like about a 10-year spurt.
Mm-hmm.
They survived for a while.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
Yeah. It's weird that all the comics that I'm talking about today are all companies that have no longer exist.
But, well, there's a lot of them from the 80s and 90s, that's for sure.
Yeah, I remember Now Comics, and I think I caught on to it. Like, I bought a few. I bought a few Married with Children, and I bought a few Fright Nights back in the day, and I bought a few Green Hornets, like when they... I don't remember what volume this is. It might be like volume 3. It's like Dynamite, where they just keep launching it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
They lasted quite a bit. I really wish I would have researched it like I did the other companies, just to see like what their downfall or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Because it is fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those 90s smaller companies, the story is pretty similar with a lot of them. They just, you know, when the market changed, wasn't enough money to support all of them.
Yeah.
They didn't change their business model now, you know, quick enough.
Yeah, this was from 1992.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's right around I stopped reading comics for the first time.
Now, the Tales from the Green Hornet. Let's see what.
It was my fault.
It's your fault.
I was the downfall of Now Comics by not having heard of them ever.
That's a damn shame. This is Tales of the Green Hornet Volume 3, Number 1. It's from 1992. So they're both from the same year, but they're probably like third volumes.
Mm-hmm.
So that you could assume, I guess, that it was around 3 years prior to it. I think they at least had a 5-year history.
Mm-hmm.
at a minimum. They were one of the bigger independent publishers at the time.
I guess I just totally missed them.
Well, they didn't have a shitload of titles. They just had titles that were well known, at least in the Wizard magazines and stuff.
Mm-hmm. What was the Married with Children comic? Just, was it a comedy comic or?
Yeah.
What?
It was based on the show, and they like launched spinoffs. Like Kelly had her own comic, and they were all mini series though.
Mm. Oh, okay. A lot of A lot of strong continuity, probably.
Oh, yeah. It had a lot of, like, I'm looking up in my database, and it launched with Volume 1, and I actually own Volume 1 from, this is from 1990, and they had, like, a Volume 2 in 1991, and then they had something in 1993. They had a 2099 special, so making fun of, like, Marvel 2099.
Yeah. Married with Children in the Future.
Yeah, they had three 3D specials, and they had one about the dog and all kinds of stuff.
I guess that show was really popular for a while.
Yeah, I was a big Married with Children fan, so I bought the comic. That's what I know now from, and I did buy some of the Green Hornets. But they probably went from like 1990 to 1995, you know, roughly.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, to tie back so that we don't go completely without any sort of connection to our long-running Fourth World saga, I didn't read a comic by Jack Kirby, but I did read a comic with a Jack Kirby character in it. I read DC Comics Presents number 12. And this was a team-up of Superman and Mr. Miracle.
Oh, God, I love that issue.
This issue is called Winner Take Metropolis, and it's written by Steve Englehart with pencils by Richard Buckler and inks by Dick Giordano. And just so that we feel right at home here on the Retrocast, it opens up like every issue of Mr. Miracle did, with Mr. Miracle in a crazy trap. He's on a TV show. He's handcuffed, blindfolded, and triple locked inside of a solid steel coffin, which is hanging 200 feet above the Las Vegas desert with two pilotless drone jets zeroing in at him at 1,000 miles per hour. And he only has 12 seconds to escape. And just like we would see in an issue of Mr. Miracle, we don't see him escape. The planes fly right into the coffin that he's in. The coffin collapses, falls all 1,000 feet to the desert, and the people that are filming the show rush in, freaking out, thinking that he's dead. And sure enough, Mr. Miracle climbs out of the cockpit of one of the pilotless drone planes that have landed nearby. And what's kind of funny is that the host of the show, this Miss Barnett, reveals that her show, though it goes out to a lot of people, it's being undercut by Galaxy Broadcasting because they're airing a Superman documentary opposite this show. So Scott Free gets a little pissed off that people are more interested in Superman than he is, even though he's actually a god from New Genesis and the son of the High Father, and Superman's just an alien from a different planet. And it's interesting because Oberon and Big Barda are there. The way that Big Barda is drawn, she's actually looks really different. She just looks like a normal woman. She's actually smaller than Scott Free. She's got real like thin waist and thin arms. She just kind of looks like a normal human that's dressed a little bit differently than normal. So she's a little bit off model, I'd say. But you know, Mr. Miracle storms off. He's on his little flying disc thingies, and but he happens to see this woman that he recognizes as Carolyn Dole, and she's an inner gang chieftain who just recently escaped from prison. He saw her on a newscast, so he follows after her, thinking that, you know, if he's able to capture her and turn her back in, that'll be good press for him and for his show and stuff. So he follows her to this hideout where there's a bunch of other inner gang people, and as he's watching through the skylight, they, you know, Carolyn asks the other inner gang members what the hell they had to summon her there for and what's the big idea and everything, and they reveal to her that they have this thing called the Mentropy machine. So I thought maybe at first that it like caused menopause in people or something. You know, like you zap men or women with it and all of a sudden, you know, menopause, which normally will take course over a period of years, just happens all at once and, you know, you pass out from the hot flashes or something. But apparently it's some kind of a mind control device, and they're planning to use it on Superman. So Scott Free, he knows that one of the ways to get in touch with Superman is to call his quote-unquote friend, Galaxy Broadcasting anchorman Clark Kent. So he does that, and he's about to say, you know, I've got a message you need to pass along to Superman. And Clark's like, yes, what is that? And Mr. Miracle Kent finds himself unable to talk. So he says, can you speak up, Mr. Miracle? I'm about to go on air in a couple minutes. And Scott still can't say what he's trying to say, so he hangs up. And he thinks, well, he'll send a telegram instead. And he goes to put pencil to paper.
That's how technology is coming into factor.
Yeah. This came out in 79 or 80. So he puts pencil to paper and finds that he can't form the words.
He should use that mother box speaker that he used it when he blew that guy's eardrum out.
Seriously. But he can't even, Big Bart and Oberon come in and he can't even figure out what the hell he was trying to do. And it's because, you know, he was, when Intergang tested out the menopause machine, he was too close by and he was affected by it. So when they mentioned Superman, because last time they saw him, he was ticked off about Superman. He's like, oh yeah, that's it. You know, I got to challenge Superman to prove I'm better than him. So the next night they put this sign up in the sky above Metropolis saying, introducing the new hero of Metropolis, Mr. Miracle. And, you know, next thing you know, every time Superman is about to go save somebody, Mr. Miracle shows up and cock blocks him and rescues the people before he gets a chance to. And so it's a pretty funny part where, you know, Mr. Miracle's just arrested some bank robbers and Superman's standing on the sidewalk with his fists on his hips, and Jimmy Olsen comes up to interview him and asks him, you know, is this getting to you, this whole thing with Mr. Miracle? And Superman says, no, that, you know, there's plenty of room in Metropolis for both of us. And Jimmy says, that doesn't bother you then, this challenge he's put down for you? And Superman says, I said it doesn't bother me, and it doesn't bother me, okay? And Jimmy says, okay. But then the next panel, there's a couple, like, pretty young ladies in the foreground, and they've got Mr. Miracle t-shirts on. And Superman's looking at him, and he says, off the record, Jimmy, it does bother me. So I guess it took, you know, seeing that Mr. Miracle's got some attractive young fans to really get to him. So, but, you know, Superman's a good guy, so he approaches Mr. Miracle and asks him if they could, you know, settle things peaceably. You know, because he's had some dealings, as we know, with people from New Gods, and they've always been reasonable. And he tells him, you know, there's a lot of other cities that need a superhero. He's got Metropolis covered, so, you know, if you don't mind, why don't you go take care of one of those other cities? And Mr. Miracle's not having it. He challenges him to a televised contest where they're going to fight in the Nevada desert and they're going to race their way back to Metropolis. And that's, you know, the only rule, really. They can do whatever they want, but they're going to start off in this place, the Nevada desert, that's become uninhabitable because of underground nuclear bomb tests. So they get there and Mr. Miracle's there first, and for some reason, as soon as he gets there, there's a really crazy storm going. And because of the storm, Mr. Miracle tells Superman, you know, if you get lost because of the storm, just follow the mountain range, because that marks the route back to Vegas. So, and then he, you know, sucker punches Superman in the chin. So they trade punches a little bit, and Mr. Miracle uses his illusion powers to, you know, to sort of balance out the power difference. He makes, this is where we get our cover, which has Superman punching his way through three fake Mr. Miracles, when the fourth one is the real one. So he's getting a little confused. But finally, Superman throws a strong enough punch that Mr. Miracle goes flying off into the distance. And but Superman's not feeling really good about the whole situation. He's kind of gotten caught up in this whole contest, and he's not feeling that great about it. So he finds the mountain range to lead him back towards Las Vegas, and then we see Mr. Miracle showing up where the where Inner Gang has their menopause machine, and and he smashes it to bits, and they're like, you know, how the hell did this guy beat Superman? We, you know, because they were just going to wait, and when Superman crossed the finish line, they were going to blast him with this with the machine and give him hot flashes, I guess. And then sure enough, Superman does show up late. And this is where Mr. Miracle reveals this crazy plan that he had, that when he got to the starting spot ahead of time, he seeded the clouds so that they would, and created the storm so that Superman would need to follow the mountains. But then he blew up the original mountains, and so that Superman would follow the second range of mountains that actually leads away from Metropolis, so that Superman would be delayed and that he would have time to blow up the machine and undo the mind control that he was trapped under. So it's a pretty crazy, convoluted plan that he had, but overall, the issue is so much fun and kind of crazy that it's definitely entertaining.
Yeah, that was the second issue I picked up off the spinner rack of DC Comics Presents. Because back when I used to go to the spinner rack, you never could guarantee the next issue you'd get.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one I got was like Green Lantern. It was a Green Lantern one. I think it was 6 or something like that. And then that Mr. Miracle one. I have a fond memory. Like, as soon as you said the issue, I like remembered the cover. Like, you know how sometimes you can remember covers that you're fond of when, you know, I remember him punching and he's punching through a bunch of different Mr. Miracles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I definitely have that with some of the early, you know, I was able to kind of start figuring out what comics I used to have in my collection when I was a kid just by flipping through pages of covers. You know, because especially those early ones, they're really imprinted on my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was fun.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, Where'd you find those ones at?
I think I got these ones just out of
dollar bins or something.
Dollar bins. I usually, you know, I'll usually grab DC Comics Presents especially if I like the, you know, the guest hero.
Yeah, I was just, as you were talking, I was just going through. I'm only missing like 5 of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
But I tagged them so I can get them. Mostly the annuals I'm missing, but
mm-hmm.
I'm missing a couple. One I know I had at one point, which is number 1. I know I had it. I don't have it in my database, so it's probably I traded it away or something.
That's a team up with the Flash, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a 2-part team up. Number 1 and 2 is the Flash.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you mentioned Dick Giordano, was his name?
Giordano.
Giordano. Well, since you did that, I'll, the next book that I'll talk about has art by Dick Giordano. And it's a very interesting company. The company is called Future Comics. It was formed around in 2001 or 2002 by Michelini, who's known for Iron Man and Spider-Man, David Michelini. Bob Layton, who's also his partner in crime for his Iron Man, you know, popular for the alcoholic time period and all that stuff. I think he even did the art for the one you just talked about in the Epic line. I think you had some Bob Layton issues there. So this series is called Death Mask, and it only ran from issues 1 to 3, and it was a monthly comic. This got me really interested in finding the other titles. There were only 3 titles that were launched. Death Mask was the third. The second one that was launched was Metallics, and the very first one that was launched was Free Mind, all by the same teams. So, this was the rough time around Valiant, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And they wanted to have a new concept, much in the vein of trying to develop superhero books so people could jump in line like Valiant and feel like it's the new Marvel. And they wanted to do this by attacking the distribution system. So what Future Comics did was allowed people to order their comics through the web. You know, this was the early time of the web and stuff. Right. And also tried to break away from the Diamond monopoly by not soliciting their books through Diamond. They went to the distributors directly, and they got like about 1,000 stores to participate and say, you could get our books like at really low discounts if you order directly from us, and then sell them for this cost. And I don't know how accurate the information I have is, because it seems to be like Bob Layton supplied it, so it might be like biased towards his viewpoint. But according to what I read, they were successful enough that Diamond came to them and said, please solicit your books in our magazine. But that made the retailers have a bad taste in their mouth, because they're like, hey, you kind of went against what you were going against. But they were like, we want to increase our distribution. But it seems like when they did that, it was kind of like the downfall of the company. And Bob Layton was already trying to re-vector the company to not do monthlies, to do trades. But that never, he was posing the company to do that. They, there is an interesting thing in there, like right before the downfall, like when they went to Diamond, their computer system was hacked. And if you remember, all their distribution and stuff was through their own website and stuff like that. Well, that hack actually is listed as one of the contributors to like destroying the company, because they lost several issues of stuff that they had out there, and they lost a lot of stuff, including like stuff with the distribution chain and how they were getting stuff out there. So it's an interesting thing. The company didn't last more than 2 years or 3 years.
Sounds like they pissed some people off.
Yeah, it sounds like they did. But it was an interesting concept. And, you know, they were trying to break away from Diamond, which I think was pretty ballsy. And also enter in the with new technology and make distribution through, you know, ordering through the, you know, website and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So Death Mask 1 through 3, it's a Native American superhero. In the first 3 issues, you don't really get to know a lot of backstory, other than he has this mask that was obtained from somebody. And he's kind of like if you had to compare him to anybody, you'd probably compare this guy to a Spectre, the Spectre you just read in the Adventure Comics. He's like a creature of vengeance that seeks out people that do criminal acts, and he takes care of him. And he does it in a very Spectre mannerism. The fact that he took one dude. You know how in the banks they have those little vacuums that suck up the... You can put your like checks in the bank, you know, through the drive-through. Have you ever seen them? And you close it, and you put your license in there and your check, and then it sucks that your check through a like a little vacuum, and it ends up in the building, and then they cash your check and they send your money back out in that same vacuum tube.
Yeah, I think it's called—is it pneumatic tubes or something like that?
Yeah, there might be that. I never even heard anybody mention them. We've used them in the past. We still use them.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is he did a death by one of those, right? He sucked one of the villains up one of those backwards. Just splat. But he's got a main nemesis. This takes place in Vegas. He's got a main nemesis in there. And he's more like a kingpin type. You know, like he's rich and wants to take the mask and trap Death Mask because he's always foiling his plots to make more money. He basically likes to step on the poor and make a lot of money, and Death Mask is always in his way, so he tries to stop him. And the last issue ends with he's got these like weird animal like creatures who are goons that used to work for him, but they morphed after Death Mask escaped from him into these like dog beasts, and that those beasts are immune to Death Mask's powers, and they were out there to kill him. So in the third issue it ends, they were trying to kill him, but you never get the end of the story because that was the last issue. But it was pretty cool, and it had great art. And if you like Michelini, like with Michelini and Bob Layton, you know you're going to get, in Giordano, you're going to get a quality book. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah, they're all definitely longtime pros by that point.
Yeah. Cool concept, cool deal. Another failed company. So now we got Now and Future Comics.
Yeah, another one that I've never heard of. But that's an interesting story for sure.
This one I had heard of, but I didn't buy into it because I don't think my shop bought into it. And by the time they did start soliciting in Diamond, it was already later. You know, in other words, it was solicited as issue 4, where they didn't. You'd have to get issues 1 and 3. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
A free mind or something like that. And I was like, I don't want to go back and order those other 4 issues or 3 issues.
Yeah. I hear you. Well, I can keep the links going in between the stuff that we've read, sort of, because I have some Spider-Man to talk about, and not written by Michelini, but from the exact same time. You know, they were crossing over with books when this was when Michelini was writing Amazing, and of course that lasted for quite a while. He was on the book for quite a while, but these are a couple specific issues from the first Amazing Spider-Man epic collection. I mentioned this last time in passing and then talked a little bit more about the Iron Man one, but this one is called Cosmic Avengers. It's from 89-90 time period, and it has more Amazing issues in it, but those are the ones I was really familiar with and had read before. So it's kind of neat to see, because the period it opens is the Acts of Vengeance, you know, and you had Magneto and Doctor Doom and the Wizard and Kingpin and a couple other villains working together and trading nemeses, you know. So they would, Magneto went after Spider-Man and also Captain America and different things like that to sort of catch these heroes off balance. Spider-Man ends up being a particular problem for the group because this also coincides with when he briefly has cosmic powers. And, you know, hence the name of the trade, Cosmic Avengers. So I read Spectacular Spider-Man, issue 160, which was written by Jerry Conway. So I got some more Conway. And the art's pencil and inks is by Sal Buscema. And it's called Fear and the Fury, or the Metal in Men's Souls. And it starts off with Dr. Doom excavating a robot called TESS 1. And TESS is an acronym.
What issue was that again?
160.
Okay.
So it's got Spider-Man standing over Shocker, Rhino, and Hydro-Man. And Dr. Doom and this robot, TESS 1, is looming in the background. And so he excavates this robot, and then we switch to Rhino and Shaco. Rhino is actually fighting Shocker and Hydro Man, and it's funny because Spider-Man jumps into the situation, you know, to protect the bystanders. They're getting hurt because these guys are battling, and it only takes like two or three panels because Spider-Man just blasts him with this cosmic power that he has, and all three of the villains go flying through a store window. But it's such a crazy display of power that the bystanders are freaked out and start throwing fruit and garbage and stuff at him. But we do get, when he's firing the ray, we see the outline of Captain Universe on around Superman, around Spider-Man. So that's one of the first indications that'll happen a few more times, that this power is actually coming from the Captain Universe power. And we'll see that, you know, come to full-fledged later on in Amazing Spider-Man. But you also have a subplot going on right now where J. Jonah Jameson has been outed from the Daily Bugle, and it's been taken over. So he's planning on starting his own newspaper, and you got this guy, Nick Katzenberg, who's a photographer, and he wants Peter Parker's job. So he doesn't want Jameson to hire Parker for his new newspaper, and so he's got shots of Spider-Man being, hit by garbage and stuff like that just happened. So this robot that Doom was excavating at the beginning of the issue, he's telling typical Dr. Doom he's got his own plans outside of the stuff with the other supervillains he's teaming up with, and he tells him he's sending the robot after after Spider-Man just to take him out, but he's actually wants to use it to get a sample of this strange power that Spider-Man's been exhibiting. And actually, this robot actually comes from the World War II era, and it was built to combat Captain America. TESS actually stands for Total Elimination of Super Soldiers. So there's a little bit of exchange between Spider-Man and Mary Jane, because they've actually just been recently married and recently moved to their Soho apartment. So not long after this is when the robot finally attacks, and Spider-Man continues this strange display of powers that he's not really comfortable with when he punches the robot, and it goes flying for what looks like 10, maybe 12 blocks or something like that over the tops of all these buildings in the city. And he just kind of talks shit on the bystanders that are around him, because he's tired of all the confusion and these powers and stuff like that, and people are just running away from him. And so he follows after where the robot probably ended up, and it's on a bridge. So he actually saves the life of a man in a car that the robot throws at him, but the guy's not all that grateful, because you know, it's New York City. And so Spider-Man, man, I really want to be talking about DC, I guess. Spider-Man finally just has enough, and there's a splash page where he uses both of his fists to shoot out these cosmic rays, and it just blows the robot to bits, including frying the gloves of his costume. And people are really freaked out at him now. You know, I get these shots of all these regular, everyday people looking at him, freaked out and running away as he starts to move towards them. And they're really kind of worried about him now. But when things close up, we see that even though Spider-Man has blasted the robot apart, there's enough shrapnel for Dr. Doom to collect the head of the robot and take it in. So he still seems to have gotten something out of it, even though, you know, his stated goal to his partners has been unsuccessful. He didn't take out Spider-Man, but really what he wanted out of it was just to get a sample of his powers, and it seems that he's been able to do that.
Is that the first issue that's in that collection?
Mm-mm, no, it...
okay.
It actually starts with Amazing Spider-Man 326.
Oh.
It has two issues of Spectacular Spider-Man prior to this.
So you just chose this one, or you'd read the other ones already?
Yeah, this is about where I was at.
Oh, okay.
So I just kind of decided to jump in there. But yeah, it opens up with Amazing Spider-Man 326, and it's kind of like I think it might be the first Acts of Vengeance issue, and that's the issue where it's around that issue where he first gets these cosmic powers, and then there's an issue of Web of Spider-Man number 59 where that features Titania and Puma.
What was Acts of Vengeance? I don't remember it.
Like I was saying, it was it had any of the issues that tied into it. What had the top right corner?
Yeah, I know the top right corner, but what was the whole premise and what did it cross over with? Was it a company wide event?
I think so. I think it crossed over into a lot of issues. I know I have some Captain America issues, and I think there was a lot of them. But it was essentially. Let me see if I can find a shot of the group of them. But like I was mentioning, Dr. Doom, Magneto, Kingpin. I think Namor was
bad guy.
Was pretty bad at the time, so I think he might have been in it.
He's been known to team up because supervillain team up was Dr. Doom and Namor.
Yeah, Wizard was I think the Fantastic Four connection, but it was supervillains of. Of all the different superheroes, and they were both individually going against people that they normally wouldn't, and also sending other supervillains against heroes that they normally wouldn't face.
Right, to throw them off. In other words, you've beaten these clowns before. Go ahead.
Yep.
Mix it up a little bit.
Yeah, and so it was kind of a vengeance thing. So...
I think I missed this event entirely.
Mm.
Like across the board, I think this is when I stopped getting Marvel.
Okay. Yeah, I mean some of the earliest issues of Marvel that I had were Acts of Vengeance crossovers, and it just was, you know, just happened to be the timing of it. It was also for Amazing. It was around the time that McFarlane left and Larson took over.
Yeah.
Was
that stuff I do have.
Time. Yeah.
The Larson Amazing. Maybe it was just Spectacular I didn't get.
Yeah, I mean, I had the Amazing. See, what's one of the things that's interesting about reading these, so I also read the next one in the volume is Web of Spider-Man 61.
Web of Spider-Man 61.
And I didn't read this back in the day either, but it was... It's also written by Jerry Conway, and the pencils are by Alex Saviak. You know, so to my eyes at the time, I was really attracted to stuff like McFarlane and Larson, Jim Lee, and stuff like that. So it's kind of nice reading these ones as an adult because I have a little bit more of an appreciation for the art style of Sal Buscema and Alex Saviak, whereas when I was a kid, it looked too plain to me. You know, my tastes were different. I wanted the bombasticness of McFarlane and Larson and the way that they drew Spider-Man, you know, contorting his limbs in impossible ways and stuff. And Buscema and Saviak were a little more realistic with their style. But, quickly I'll say that Web of Spider-Man 61 is a pretty direct continuation. Peter Parker is pretty tired of, he's about to give up and he's pretty sick of the whole situation. He's actually on top of this tower and throws his mask, and the wizard happens to be nearby and catches it, and he takes it back to the council. Looks like Red Skull was in on this also, and the Mandarin are seated at this table with the other ones that I mentioned. So they're actually discussing Spider-Man because of the fact that he's created more of a problem for them than any other superheroes that they've gone after because of the cosmic powers that they are, you know, confused about. And the wizard actually sends Dragon Man after Peter. And they end up battling in the subway because Peter's on his way. He's taking the subway up to Queens to visit Aunt May. And Dr. Doom still, so we also see Dr. Doom collecting the data that he got from the Test One robot, but it ends up being so powerful that it blows up his machinery, so he's able not to collect the data, and Namor is watching him from a distance, kind of finding out that Dr. Doom's up to some stuff out on the side there. But the gist of this, though, is that the wizard kind of fails, that the whole thing that he wanted to take Spider-Man out once and for all, because, it seems like his morale was low and wanting to quit and stuff, but the opposite ends up happening, that the whole battle between him and Dragon Man in the subways, all the people that Spider-Man saves the lives of that are on this subway car end up cheering him and telling him he's a hero no matter what anybody says about him. So it ends up actually rejuvenating Spider-Man and gives him the will to fight again. And then our cliffhanger is has to do with Elizabeth and Harry Osborn, who are actually living in the same building and at this time with their baby, living in the same building as Peter and Mary Jane. And Elizabeth Osborn gets a mysterious phone call. this is kind of, as far as Spider-Man is concerned, it's kind of the end of Acts of Vengeance, and it just makes me cry. My voice is fine. But yeah, that's the next issue, Amazing Spider-Man 329. Is where the Captain Universe powers come into full fruition, and he's actually, has the Captain Universe costume on over top of his Spider-Man costume because he has the powers to go up against the Tri-Sentinel, an amalgamation of three Sentinels in one. And this issue actually is one that I did have and read as a kid. So it's kind of neat to look at that again, but it's pretty funny because the trade opens with 326, as I was saying, and in that issue he goes up against this dude Graviton. I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah, I remember him. He's even appearing on something of the Avengers Assemble or some cartoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny because he chooses the wrong moment to try to get revenge. For getting beat a few issues earlier, and at this point now, before he got his Captain Universe powers, and he chooses this moment to to go up against him right before he turns into Captain Universe, and Spider-Man just blasts him with a cosmic ray, and he goes flying through a water tower and crashes into a car, and he's just knocked out. He's like, maybe I should go up against less powerful opponents like Galactus.
I don't want to interrupt, but I wanted to ask you, collection have 328 in it too? The McFarlane Hulk issue? Okay.
Yeah, it has.
Because that's Amazing. Acts of Vengeance. I just... I do have Acts of Vengeance, but I guess for some reason the only... I might have only been collecting a handful of Marvel, and like you said, I was in there for the Eric Larson and McFarlane stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I know the Amazing Spider-Man issues that are included in here, but I didn't know the Web and Spectacular and during Acts of Vengeance, at least they went back and forth. Like the storyline continued through all three Spider-Man titles, and then it ends actually after. These two that I just covered in detail, those are the last Spectacular and Web that are in this issue, and then it just has a bunch of Amazing Spider-Man in a row. So it looks like, you know, this epic collection is just to collect Amazing, but they're putting in Spectacular and Web when they happen to cross over and you need them for the complete story.
I didn't need them back then.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't need them either. I didn't need them in the sense.
Well, let me ask you: did you feel you missed anything? Like, did you miss a key? Like going from one book to the other book because you just crossed over three books.
Yeah, and I when I read them as a kid, I felt like I caught what was going on because they gave you some editor's notes and they clued you in on dialogue. But you know, reading them now, it's more of a complete story. So, I mean, it is cool reading them. You can understand what's going on because they made an effort to let you know what was going on within the dialogue and everything like that, because Marvel was pretty good about that at the time. But
saying you could have just read Amazing and you wouldn't have, because the editor would have caught you up.
Yeah, you could.
Would have been missing the details or...
Yeah, and especially since I read them as a kid and I'm rereading them now, it's cool to see parts of the story I never read back then.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is supposedly volume 20 of Amazing Spider-Man Epic Collection, and it has Amazing Spider-Man 326 through 333, Spectacular Spider-Man 158 and 160, Web of Spider-Man 59 and 61, and then it has it has one annual each, and those are that's the parts 1, 2, and 3 of Spidey's Tiny Adventure.
Yeah, which you've already covered.
Yeah, that I mentioned. But the other amazing stuff, that the stories that are in, it's a two-parter with Punisher. 330 and 331 is a story with Punisher. And then 332 and 333 are a Venom story. A Venom and Sticks and Stone. These are all issues I had when I was a kid, but it's cool to revisit them, and they're very, like, my memory is definitely, I read those too. I mean, my memory is definitely coming back to me as I read them, but you know, you had the you had the subplot with Black Cat dating Flash Thompson to get back at Peter Parker for breaking her heart. And the whole thing with Sticks and Stone is that you had the subplot with the billionaire or whatever he is that's obsessed with Mary Jane.
Mm-hmm.
And he had kidnapped her earlier.
I remember that plot.
Yeah. So he sends Sticks and Stone after Spider-Man. It just is a coincidence that it's at the exact same time that Venom escapes from captivity and goes after him as well. So he's having to deal with all three of them at once. And it's funny because this is when Mary Jane is starring on the soap opera. They call it Secret Hospital. Obviously, it's supposed to be General Hospital. Yeah, and they're like, Peter goes to meet her for dinner at on the set on her lunch break, and they're like, what's going on? You know, somebody like obsessed with both of us. Because, you know, he's got Felicia after him and she's got the dude, the billionaire dude after him, her. So. Spider-Man. I mean, Spider-Man was definitely my favorite when I was a kid. He's still probably my favorite Marvel. I mean,
that was my favorite time for Spider-Man.
Yeah.
This Michelini and Eric Larson and McFarlane time.
Mm-hmm.
It was shipping bi-monthly at one point.
Yeah, it started in Larson's run.
Yeah.
That was the only comic I've ever had a mail subscription to was Amazing Spider-Man when Larson was drawing it. And when Larson went off the book to form Image, I dropped it like a hot potato. And bought Savage Dragon number one.
Yeah, I was looking at the cover with Sticks and Stones, and he drew Sticks. It looks like a McFarlane face.
Yeah.
So it's like, you could see the evolution of Eric Larson. Like, he had a style that had certain detail that you don't see in it now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. With Savage Dragon.
Yeah, it wasn't a very... it was a pretty smooth transition. I think you know, people were so high on McFarlane.
Yeah.
I think he tried to make his style a little bit more like McFarlane's than he does now. But, yeah, Sticks and Stone are a pretty funny duo.
Yeah, skinny old man and a younger dude.
It's and they sort of inverse the expectation that, because Stone's like the big muscle dude, but he's the one that's actually really smart. And Sticks is the one you would expect to maybe be the brains, and he's kind of just too nuts to know what's going on. He's constantly trying to kill stuff with his power.
Right. So,
like, he like zaps the bird that the billionaire owns and kills it, and then like later on when they go to meet with him again, he's got a new bird and he kills it again. He just wants to kill everything, and Stone's got to keep him from like murdering people constantly.
Yeah, those epic books seem really interesting. I was just thumbing through the latest previews, and it has a Thor, a new Thor volume.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just wish they would have started at the beginning and worked their way up.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I kind of like that they're not, just because that stuff's so easy to find. But I think some of those will probably come out later this year for the anniversary. At least that's what they've hinted at, that they might do some volume ones. But yeah, like we've talked about before, it's definitely has a lot more appeal if you haven't already collected other collections of Marvel.
Yeah. But. Well, I got one more book to talk about. I'll hold off on the 2005 one because it's breaking the rule. But I'll go to 2003, which is like right on the rule. Like 11 years ago.
Yeah.
This was around the time that CrossGen ended their line of titles, roughly. CrossGen was a unique publisher, and they started their lineup based on these things called the sigils, or call them what you will. I don't know how to pronounce it. S-I-G-I-L.
I think it's sigil.
Sigils. And they're these weird little hippie sperm-looking symbols.
Does hippie sperm look different than normal sperm?
Yeah, I don't know. They just have the colors. Hippie sperm has funny colors.
There's going to be
normal
a lot more.
Sperm is just white.
There's going to be a lot more of that in Colorado now.
Yeah.
The new law. There's going to be hippie sperm everywhere.
Everywhere. So Mystic was one of the original ones that was launched. And they launched a lot of these characters. They would get these symbols. And they launched them in different scenarios, like Meridian was more like in a fantasy world. That was one of my favorites, Meridian. I loved it. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was called Sigil. That was a sci-fi type world. And then this one was a magic world. They had all these different worlds. And the only thing linking the books together were these symbols. They never crossed over, for that matter, until the end in the Negation War, when the company went under. But CrossGen did a lot of interesting things I just want to mention real quick. They delved into the collections, like anthology collections. Like, I think they're one of the first companies to do that. In other words, they put out like a book that had, oh, if you like magic, you'll like these three titles. If you like sci-fi, get these.
Mm-hmm.
And they would collect like the single issues in a trade, and then you'd follow those particular issues in trade format. So they were like a pathfinder in how trades, you know, they released trades, they did anthology trades. In other words, if you were to get a Mystic trade, you could either get the Mystic trade or you could get the Magic one, which had many titles. So it's a way to explore many of their books instead of just one.
And I think some of those were digest sized, weren't they? Or they would?
Yeah, I think they had two different sizes. One was like a regular size, and one was like a digest size.
I remember those were even in Barnes and Noble for a while.
Yeah, that's another interesting point I want to mention. They also did a lot with digital stuff, so they released their stuff on CD-ROM, so you could, you know, they were like pathfinding their way because they knew technology was going to change things. They, towards the end there, they started putting them on CDs, and I remember going to my first San Diego Comic-Con. CrossGen was there, and they had like a big TV where they were showing, you know, like the results of the CD, and sometimes they would try to do more than just show a PDF. They would try to put audio and sound to it, you know, sound quality to it as well. And the other interesting thing is they released their stuff in Barnes and Noble, and they said that was one of the reasons that they think led them to bankruptcy. Not because it was a good idea. It was a good idea to do it, but Barnes and Noble and all those companies, they have return policies where they can return the books back to the retailer and get their money refunded, or at least a certain portion of their money refunded. And I think that happened a lot with CrossGen. They got a lot of books sent back, and they had to refund that money. So it was like a gamble they were taking.
Yeah.
But this title was amazing. It was by these ones I never read before. So I had them, but for some reason I didn't read issues 38 through 43, which is the end of Mystique. And it's by Tony Bedard with art by Aaron Lopresti, and he is freaking phenomenal in this book. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like the best art that I've ever seen him do. It's like every page I would just die to have. It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But it has Giselle and her sister. Her last name is Villard, and she gets the symbol. And where this starts off is she starts off, they've taken the magic away from her. She's now imprisoned by another faction of magicians that are trying to take over everything. And she's imprisoned in a dungeon with one of her former enemies, Daro. And Daro looks like shit. He looks like he's aged by about 25 years. He's all bearded. He shits in the corner. it was weird because, you know, Giselle gets in there and she's like, you know, we're in prison here together. And she's like trying to introduce herself. And she's like, God, what's the smell? And he goes, well, that's our bathroom over there in that corner. That's where I've been shitting for the last, you know, 5 years. And I guess they have to share that shithole. And it just, it's like something out of a zombie Toilet of the Dead movie. it's so interesting. But there's this faction that's taken over magic everywhere, and they've depowered all the other factions that have the magic. And they've also taken away, like with this, the sigil, she used to be able to talk to all the different spirits of the magicians that were in different factions, like, and she would like learn lessons from them, and she couldn't access them anymore. She couldn't access those powers anymore. She was like totally away from them. And then they were in the dungeon, and then they bring her sister in, and all of the other guys that are her sister's allies, they've basically captured everybody. They've depowered them. They can't do anything because they have no power. But the one thing that they forgot to do is take away her bra, because her bra has these pins in them, and she can get her way out of the cell, and there's no guards in the cell because I guess they didn't think to put guards there, because they said, how are they ever going to escape? They have no magic. But her bra got her out. She escaped, and her and Daro defeated that other magician, and magic was not restored at that time. So, and then her sigil was removed, so she thought she had no magic, and then she had to end up going to this one land where there's this really weird creature with that looks like a chipmunk that's always next to her, that's kind of her guide, and he kind of is telling her the magic's within you. It's not just the sigil. The sigil just amplifies it. And he's trying to teach her a lesson, so he like teleports her away to this land she's been to before with these Yetis. And that was totally hilarious, because the Yeti, you know, tells her a lot of stories. And this Yeti is awesome, because he was not only good with magic, which he no longer has, but he's incredibly smart. And he was telling her a lot of the backstory of his stuff and how she could get the magic back. He's trying to help her get the magic back. But that's how it at the end of the storyline, he basically returns the magic to her, and they restore everything back to normal, and then the negation war starts. Somebody comes from the negation war and says, Gassel, we need your help. And then the negation war starts and then never finishes. So it's another title. I don't know what... This is just coincidence that I fell in this path. I didn't, like, decide to read all the titles that were ending. It's just a weird coincidence. But, man, I absolutely loved it. And there was one scene in there that was so funny that I had to post it on Keith's wall, because the Yeti's talking about how one of the female Yetis that he loved rejected him. And he was rejected because the other Yeti that he had to fight for this female for did like this weird pinch move on him and took away his stink. And because he no longer had that stink, the female was no longer interested in him. And there's a scene that the Yeti's telling her, you know, telling Gassel, you just got to find your stink juice. We all have stink juice. And the stink juice is within you. You just need to find it. And I was like laughing out loud. I was like, that shit is funny. It reminded me of Keith.
Is that how he attracted his wife?
Yeah. Well, it was weird because, do you watch Arrow?
Mm-mm, I've only seen the first two episodes, I think.
Well, in the first season, not to spoil anything, but he's got a move that can actually, it's like this judo move or karate move where he can make it look like he kills you, mm-hmm. but you're not dead, like your heart stops and everything. And it was very similar to a scene in here. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, I thought you were going to say you posted the picture of the guy pooping in the corner, because that's what he does during DC Noise.
They didn't show him pooping. They just showed the corner with, like, gas emitting from it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. But this was, man, this series was amazing. And it actually made me want to go reread. It made me want to go get my cross-gen stuff out and reread it.
Yeah, I've been tempted at times to start collecting the cross-gen stuff, because I used to have a lot of it. I actually got on cross-gen right at the beginning, and I didn't buy everything in print, but they were also one of the first to have an online subscription service like Marvel Unlimited is now, where you could, and I subscribed to that for a little while and caught up on the issues that I didn't get, you know, where you would log in on the website and then you could read anything that you wanted for a flat rate.
They did that before Marvel did it, didn't they?
Yeah, it was either that or around the same time, but so up to a certain point, like I didn't read CrossGen all the way to the end, but up to a certain point I read almost everything. And there, like you said, there were some creators who I really became aware of them and became a fan of them because of CrossGen, and Aaron Lopresti was definitely one of them. His artwork on Mystic, I just was just like really...
Oh my God, where he drew the dragons and stuff. They're just so freaking rendered, so much detail.
Yeah, I mean, that's why to this day, I mean, I, you know his name. And another one that's, you know, still around that I really became aware of from CrossGen was Paul Pelletier.
And he did one of these issues, too. He was a guest penciler for one of the ones I did.
Yeah, I think he was the book, you know, that ended up leading into the Negation War. It was just...
Negation?
Was just called Negation, yeah. I think he was the regular penciler on that. And, you know, I just... That's where I discovered him, too. And Tony Bedard, you know, as the writer of Mystic.
He wrote quite a bit of titles.
Yeah. I think I became aware of his writing through CrossGen also. They had a lot of people, you know, Mark Waid. A lot of the stuff, like the new stuff that Marvel has done with CrossGen, the only one that really gives you a reflection of what it was actually like was Ruse, because Mark Waid was the original writer on the CrossGen, but the other stuff that they've done is really kind of different than the original CrossGen stuff. And but yeah, they put out a lot of good stuff.
And so the first wave was the Sigil, which is that military science fiction one that I was talking about. Mystique was the magical one. Meridian was like that folklore fantasy. Scion was like King Arthur fantasy. And then the CrossGen Chronicles was like an anthology to get you to know about more about the universe, to try to link stuff together. And later on, they had the first, which was pretty awesome. Like, I finished most of these titles. The Ruse, I read a lot of it, but I think it's like this title. I didn't finish reading it. You know, I didn't read everything of it. I have them, but I never completed reading it, just like this. Negation was the other sci-fi superhero type thing about a prison. And then they had Route 66. That was a horror. So they delved in the horror anthology, The Way of the Rat, and then The Path, which was, those were all titles that I got and liked.
And yeah, Way of the Rat was pretty cool. That was kind of like a Master of Kung Fu kind of.
Yeah. And they had El Cazador towards the end, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Crux, and Wraith, which was like a Conan one.
Yeah, I forgot about Crux. And then Zion, that was early Greg Land.
Yeah. No, that wasn't Scion. That was Sojourn.
Oh, Sojourn, yeah.
Sojourn was more like Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Than Scion was.
Yeah, and that's what I meant. Who was on Meridian as the artist when it launched? Was that Steve McNiven?
Let me look it up. Just go to my database here. Oh, it was a big dude. I think it was the guy who did Meridian. It was Josh Middleton. And then Steve McNiven came in, like you said.
Okay. Alright.
So it was Steve McNiven. I think he did the bulk of the series, but you have Steve McNiven and a couple of people that just came in to do an issue here and there, mm-hmm. and Josh Middleton. And then Sojourn was, like you said, Greg Land.
Yeah, a lot of those people.
And everybody, that was the one that hit big. Like, it became popular.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one that, like, put them on the map. It was Ron Mars and Greg Land. And then Meridian, which was my favorite. That we just talked about Meridian. That was my favorite. What was the other one?
Mystic was the one you were just talking about.
Mystic. Who launched that one? So many Mystic comics.
I think that was Tony Bedard from the beginning, wasn't it?
That was Ron Mars.
Oh, Ron Mars started out. Okay.
And
Ron Mars wrote a lot. Ron Mars started out writing a lot of the stuff.
Yeah. The one that I wanted to look up was Scion. I wanted to look at who did that. That was also one of my favorites. These are ones that I did finish.
Mm-hmm.
That was Ron Mars and Jim Chung. That's what it was.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah. They were like fucking no joke, man. They got top talent to do these things.
Yeah, because that's where I found about Jim Chung also. And a lot of them, when CrossGen went out of business, a lot of them ended up going to Marvel, and a lot of them were, that when Marvel did that whole Young Guns thing, a lot of them are comprised of people that came over from...
Oh, yeah. They got jobs right away. They knew these guys were badass, and they could hire them. The other thing CrossGen did was bullpen-type style. In other words, instead of have freelance work, they all wanted everybody to move to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And work out of a bullpen mode.
Yeah, and they tried to give them... I mean, they tried a lot of things, you know, that were good. I mean, they tried to give them steady, like, health insurance and stuff like that. I think that's what attracted a lot of people in the first place. You know, and there was a number of things that they weren't able to follow up on that they promised, but it was definitely enough to attract a lot of people down there, a lot of big names, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And people that kind of were...
Mark Waid and Butch Geis and the... Roos.
Mm-hmm.
They had a good steady, and they were, and you have to admit, they were very different. Like, they were tapping into a market that I think hadn't been tapped into before, you know.
Mm-hmm. And what I liked was that there were so many different genres, you know.
Yeah.
It ended up kind of, they ended up kind of dropping the ball on it later on, but initially, the fact that they was the same universe, but they're only loosely tied together and didn't really cross over a lot, it gave them a way to do a lot of different genres. They didn't really, kind of like how Valiant is now. I mean, there's enough of there's some connection to superheroics, but none of them, you know, a lot of them at least don't fall strictly under superhero.
Yeah.
I mean, the style of writing and art might be similar, but if you had to really categorize it strictly as a genre, it might fall under like science fiction or fantasy or something like that. And I mean, they tried pretty much anything they could think of, like pirates, martial arts, fantasy, like they did it all.
Yeah. They did it well, too. And it lasted, you know, the issues lasted into their 30s or 40s, so...
Yeah.
They had a fairly good run before it all fell apart. And they also expanded stuff. Like, they had their own creator online where they'd do properties and other things. Like it was called CGE or something like that. Cross-Gender Entertainment. Or I can't remember what it stood for, but they would do, like, Lady Death. They had a mm-hmm. relaunch of Lady Death. They had the Masters of the Universe for a while. They had... crossovers, a couple of other things that came out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all good stuff. But I think what it led to is a bunch of people toward the end not getting paid and a lot of ill will.
Yeah.
Even though the ideas and concepts were cool, I think a lot of people left unhappy.
Yeah, definitely. It didn't end well, unfortunately.
Yeah. But, damn, that's good stuff. I'm glad that I took this path down defunct companies.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that you didn't plan it out, because it seems like you chose to feature, you know, defunct companies.
Yeah, I just ran into these, like I was sorting books that I haven't read, back issues, mm-hmm. and I ran into these, and I was like, wow, Mystique, I wonder how... Now it made me want to go look through a couple other boxes that I know I have, mm-hmm. where I have like the Ruse and the stuff that I didn't finish, and I know I didn't finish Route 666. So there's some titles that I didn't finish. I know I finished Meridian. I didn't finish Sigil, which is a sci-fi one, because it was my least favorite by far. Mm-hmm. Didn't care for that one. At least initially. It was always the bottom of the pile for me.
I don't remember that one that well.
That was Barbara Kessel and Ben Lai. Let's kick that one off. But it lasted 42 issues, but it had like Chuck Dixon towards the end and Dale Eaglestrom, so I mean, it had big names.
Oh, right, yeah, that's right, Chuck Dixon did write a bunch of
Scott
stuff.
Scott Eaton, Andy Smith. Some good stuff. Yeah. I didn't know you got into it, the digital piece. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I forgot that they did that, like the web-based stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the way I kind of caught up on the stuff I didn't have in print, but... I don't know exactly. I'd have to do some research to figure out when exactly I stopped. I know I didn't read up all the way up to the end, but I think it was pretty close. I mean, I think I probably I definitely read 3/4 of the stuff that they published.
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, a lot of it. There's some really quality stuff outside of superhero genre. That I mean, Way of the Rat. That was a really cool book. That was interesting.
The first, which was a bunch of gods, that was interesting. Crux, Barbarian. There was all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, the first was kind of like mythology, and they were sort of the pantheon of gods.
There you go, yeah, the pantheon. And they were very soap opera oriented, about them messing with each other. And
yeah, they were sort of the gods of the cross-gen universe, but they were definitely... It was like a new pantheon of gods, but they were definitely influenced by like Greek and Roman gods, the way that they would, they would act like, they would have human emotions and jealousies and things like that. And I think there was a couple different, like allegiances within the first, you know, that like gods that banded together against each other and stuff.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, which that was pretty cool.
And I read Negation number one, and it had in a couple of panels the characters from the Way of the Rat. So I was looking for Meridian because I wanted to see if Mystique. I was looking to see if she showed up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't seen her in there. And it only lasted 2 issues, but Derek pointed out that Bedard did script 3, 4, 5, and 6. You just have to read them in prose format if you want to finish the story.
For which one?
For Negation War.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because the regular Negation comic, I think, from the beginning, had signs that it was going to tie into, you know, be a crossover type of thing. Yeah. Too bad that that Marvel's not really doing anything with the properties.
Yeah, I always thought that some of these properties could make a damn good movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Fantasy movies or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there is actually a movie called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah, but I don't think it was based on this one.
No, the only thing that's in common is the title. It is a really good movie, though, actually.
Yeah.
It's really funny.
That one didn't last too long and was towards the end.
Yeah.
Where the book started to go away from the sigil and go into more other areas. Like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the pirate one. I don't think there was a Sigel, or I can't pronounce it. I'm going to keep pronouncing it wrong the whole damn time. But I don't think it was in the pirate book either.
Yeah, I think towards the end they just made them, you know, genre pieces. They didn't try to tie them into the overall cross-gen universe. But yeah, El Cazador was another one that was going to be, like, started right towards the end. But it was a really high-quality book. I mean, it would have been a really cool pirate comic. You know, that was another one that...
Yeah, Chuck Dixon and Steve Epting. I mean...
Yeah, and I mean, it introduced me to so many creators, because I don't know if that's where... But, I mean, I followed Steve Epting to Marvel, because I continue to really love his work. So, yeah, I mean, they're quality books, you know, but... You know, they're just properties that are sitting there now. I could see... I mean, if somebody else, or if Marvel sold it or something like that, or somebody else picked it up, you know, they
could see IDW doing it, because they've brought back, like, some, you know, Eclipse and Kamiko stuff properties.
Yeah. But, I mean, if they did a rollout the way that the new Valiant has done, you know, where they started with just they slowly rolled out titles, picked the properties that had the most chance, and just built up slowly and had a smart business model behind it, I think that the properties are good enough to work, but might not ever see that.
Right.
Of course, at one point, people said that about Valiant, so.
Yeah, but they came back through long legal process.
Yeah. So.
Well, do you got anything else you want to talk about? Any other books?
I think that kind of wraps things up for me this time.
Seems like my reviews were more company-centric than reviews of the actual comic itself, but they were interesting.
No, I think that's interesting, though, especially in the case for me of the first two, because they're not ones I'm familiar with.
Yeah, the Future Comics one was a very interesting diamond thing.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see how these companies that are now defunct... innovate ideas that are picked up by other companies, you know, cross-gen, like you said. I mean, that's one of the things that's interesting, that maybe if people weren't collecting when cross-gen was around, they just know them as a defunct publisher that Marvel owns the rights to now.
You kind of wonder if they didn't grow so fast, if they'd still be around, you know, like it would be so damn interesting to see if things that they did right versus things they did wrong, and if they could still be in today's market.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are properties that big companies know that are big, because when they go bankrupt, they go after them. Disney went after, you know, CrossGen. Mm-hmm. Then Marvel got a hold of it. Then they merged. It's ironic that all that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And there was a company that even came in after that, Checkerbox, and they started doing reprints of all their material. I think in like a trade type format, but I already had the issues, so I never got the reprints, but
yeah,
I think these books would be pretty rare to get if they ever got more popular, especially towards the end of the run.
Yeah, I think right now they're sort of sitting there as stuff that there's not much of a demand for them, but if the demand picked up like it did for old Valiant stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there's obviously a limited supply of the stuff out there, and that's your way to read a lot of the stuff. I mean, because the trades that are out there, too, those are in limited supply, and not everything is traded, you know. So the demand right now isn't there, you know.
Yeah.
Man, I don't know, maybe I should start buying them. So I don't decide later.
I think I'm missing towards the pirate book. Like, I'm missing that's kind of when I was like cutting back, I think.
Yeah.
And I basically cut out like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I might have a few of them, like the first two issues, and then the pirate one, I might have the first two issues, but I think I'm missing a boatload of the end.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm missing the Lady Death, even that was and the He-Man stuff. The He-Man stuff, I never was a He-Man fan, so I never got it. But now I'm reading the DC one, and I'm enjoying it. So, yeah, it's awesome that you got into it. I didn't realize you did it through the digital. I mean, you're paving the way as a reader.
Yeah.
To the way you're reading comics today, at least a good portion of them.
Well, I mean, I still read most of my stuff in paper.
Yeah, but you have, like, subscriptions to the Marvel.
I have had the subscription to the Marvel, and I guess I go through phases with how much I read on
but
there.
But your soon-to-be wife would probably like you to do more digital.
Yeah, right now it's...
What is all this crap around here? Why is this Axe of Vengeance comic right over here? Whole stack of them.
I guess it helps. I'm pretty good at keeping all the comics in one room in the house.
Yeah.
Not letting them spread out too much, so...
What are you trying to say?
I don't know. I'm not implying anything about anybody. I remember, you know, it's perfectly reasonable to have comics all over the kitchen.
Yeah. It's reasonable to me.
Yeah, who needs to? I mean, the refrigerator, that's not to store food. It's to keep
comics cool.
at a reasonable temperature so they don't. Yeah.
All right. So you want to wrap this one up?
Yes, might as well.
And then hopefully you'll let me know if you could get your situation squared away for the next episode.
Yeah, I there was no way of me foreseeing the setback that occurred.
Yeah, that's not your fault. That's not anything you could control.
No, but I was going to say that I can't see any reason why I wouldn't be ready next time, but I didn't really see any reason why I wouldn't have been ready this time.
Yeah.
So who knows what's going to happen, but yeah, it should be good for next time, as far as I know.
Cool beans. That one is going to... I hope you like it. I hope you like it. I was very anxious because I didn't know if I would... I have so fond memories of it. I didn't know if it was one of those things that I would rewatch or revisit and be disappointed with.
Right. Yeah, you never know.
Yeah.
You never know if it's going to stand up for you or not.
And it stood up like even more than I thought it would. But I'm definitely a lot older than you two. So.
Yeah. But I'm pretty open-minded to older stuff, and you know I'm pretty forgiving when it comes to some of the things that you have to deal with when you're, you know, I'm not someone that just watches new movies and reads new stuff, and mm-hmm. and I'm regularly going back to older material and stuff. So that in that regard, I'm not concerned. So. So we'll see.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you later, and let's give our information.
All right.
This was episode 24.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad. I was gonna say actually, I don't know what episode it was, but but I do know that you can go to geekbrunchpodcast.com. And you can find the show there as well as the regular Geek Brunch with Micah and Bill instead of me. You can find us on Twitter at Mike Myers Brunch or Mythmaking ETC. And that mythmakingetc@gmail.com is my email, and Mike's is Mike@comicbooknoise.com. Go to iTunes if you could and give us a rating and a review. And it's the same feed for the regular Geek Brunch podcast. So, you know, you could specify that you're reviewing the Retrocast if you do that. Anything else?
You had a new myth-making episode come out this week, right? Thursdays you're releasing them?
Yeah, I started releasing them on Thursdays. I just put out an episode on a different DC Comics Presents issue Superman versus, you know, versus, but crossing over the Firestorm, so that kind of connects into stuff I talked about today. And I just recorded in this weekend the new episode's going to come out, episode 11. It's going to come out on this upcoming Thursday. I'm finishing up the five-part look at Avengers Under Siege. So you can find that in iTunes also. Episodes are usually like 20 minutes or so. So it's just a short little addendum to the show, I guess you could think of it as.
Yeah.
Because obviously,
you drive to work after you listen to it.
Yeah. I mean, I assume that after people listen to 2 or 3 hours of this show.
Unless you have a 3 hour commute.
all they want is just is more of my voice, and I'm sure.
Yeah, that's what it is.
I'm sure that's the case, so you can.
Or the special effects that you do.
Right. Yeah, the most recent episode that came out of old audio when I briefly did a podcast for like 7 episodes or so.
I think that's the one I was listening to.
And
so, it had a voice of Superman and a voice of Killer Frost.
Yeah, I changed the like pitch on my voice for Superman. Then I raised the pitch, so because obviously, you know, women's voice sound just like me, but
yeah,
and that Superman sounds like this. Actually, in the upcoming. The upcoming episode, I didn't put special effects on, but I did do a dramatic reenactment of Captain America and Baron Zemo, but I just changed my own voice. I didn't
resort to technology.
I'm too lazy to go through and change the pitch, so
yeah.
I just talk like this for Captain America and talk like this for Baron Zemo.
Is that how you imagine
it's I guess. I don't know. It was a way of making him sound different so you could tell who was who, I guess.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I guess that's how Baron Zemo talks. I don't know. It's ridiculous.
But. All right. Well, you have a good week, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah, you too.
We might have to
move
the day or something because No, we won't. I'm getting confused. It's Sunday. No, it's Saturday that I'll be gone. Okay.
Well, if you do, let me know.
Yeah. All right. Well, have a good one. Take care. Bye bye.
All right. Skype's cutting out us. Skype. Bye bye.
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 In the year 1987. NASA launched the last of America's deep space probes. Aboard this compact starship, a lone astronaut, Captain William Buck Rogers, was to experience cosmic forces beyond all comprehension. In a freak mishap, his life support systems were frozen by temperatures beyond imagination. Ranger 3 was blown out of its planned trajectory into an orbit 1,000 times more vast, an orbit which was to return Buck Rogers to Earth.